And tonight on the program, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence and can it threaten our existence. We're going to check in with James Barrett. He's the author of the book, Our Final Intervention. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. James Barrett, of course, has had a long fascination with artificial intelligence. It really came to a head in 2000 when he interviewed some of the greatest minds of the future, and including, of course, the legendary Arthur C. Clarke. And here he is on Coast to Coast. James, welcome. How are you, sir?
Just great. Thank you very much, George. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. Great work with your book, by the way, Our Final Intervention.
Sorry, it's Our Final Invention.
Invention. Yeah, I've got it written down as intervention, but good. The moment you got involved in artificial intelligence, what was that moment for you that just clicked?
Well, I'll tell you exactly when it was. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I've been making films for National Geographic and Discovery and public television for a long time. In 2000, I've always been interested in AI, but in 2000, year 2000, I got to interview Ray Kurzweil, the inventor, Rodney Brooks, who's the head of iRobot, he's a robot maker, and science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke, who's just kind of a legend. And those conversations that I had with them really got me fired up about not just AI, but the benefits of AI, and then finally with speaking with Arthur C. Clarke, some of the dangers of AI.
The power of artificial intelligence, let's say 20 years ago, I mean, how much was out there? Probably not much at all.
No, and you know, the computers of that time were about 1,000 times bigger than they are today. You have more computing power in your smartphone than was in the Apollo 11 rocket. Way back in the 80s and 90s, you had to get in line to use a giant mainframe computer at your college. Now we're all carrying around processors that are thousands and thousands of times faster than those room-sized computers. So that's part of the growth of computers and of AI. It grows exponentially. It grows extremely quickly.
And what do you think AI could be 20 years from now?
Well, this is the issue. Is it going to be as smart as us? Is it going to be smarter than us? Ray Kurzweil, who's been pretty good at anticipating the future of computing, thinks that we'll have human-level intelligence by about 2029, and we'll be able to model precisely all the nuances and facets of the human brain by about 2029. So you'll be carrying around another supercomputer in your pocket. You'll be carrying around the kind of computer that only NASA and Oak Ridge Laboratories and the Defense Department has, but it'll be in your pocket.
James, will it ever have emotion?
That's a really, really good question. I think in the short term, the answer is no. And in fact, it's dangerous to think of computers as having emotion. That's anthropomorphizing. That's giving them human-like characteristics, and that's actually a vulnerability of ours. If we think about machines as if they're human, that's a problem for us, because then we aren't prepared for the way they'll actually behave, because they're not going to behave like humans.
Technically, and I've always been fascinated by this, but how do they create artificial intelligence with these little chips? I mean, how do they do this?
Well, a chip is nothing more than a processor processes programs, and computer programs are just lists of instructions. So you create a computer program, it's a list of instructions, you run it through a processor, it executes those instructions. It does it incorrectly, you go back and rewrite your program. The faster the processor, the faster those instructions are completed. But what AI has done is now they're taking previously abilities that were only, that used to be human cognitive abilities alone, and they're putting them in computers. So if intelligence is the ability to achieve goals and to learn and to adapt to new environments, programs and processors give those abilities to a machine. So these machines have cognitive powers that we used to have, or that we had, that we used to have only, like reasoning, planning, learning. Mm-hmm. And the processor makes that faster and faster. And that processor speed doubles just about every year.
That's dramatic. You know, it took Albert Einstein years to develop the E equals MC squared formula. Had he had computers much like we have today, with that kind of intelligence, how quickly do you think he would have come up with that?
I think he would have come up with that a lot more quickly, probably when he was still working at the post office.
Yeah.
And he would have come up with a lot more. You know, AI and our computers are really intelligence amplifiers. They give us access to very broad knowledge databases. They make our calculations a lot faster. And you can carry them with you, so they're really, really powerful tools. He would have. It's hard to guess what he would have come up with.
Well, with James Barrett, author of Our Final Invention, as we talk about artificial intelligence, give me your definition, James, of AI.
Okay, I scratched the surface of it a minute ago. You know, there, a lot of for every I'm not a scientist, but for every scientist you talk to, you'll get a slightly different version of this, but. If intelligence is the ability to achieve goals in an environment, to be aware of your environment, to learn, and to adapt to new environments. So that's intelligence. Artificial intelligence is the science of developing intelligent machines and software that do those things. And for example, you could search through the internet page by page to find information about something that you were looking for, mm-hmm. So you wanted to find out information about ants. Well, you could search each page of the internet. A machine can do that search also. It can do it a lot better.
At incredible speed.
Yes, at incredible speed. So AI, artificial intelligence, is taking a cognitive power that we have, like search or like reasoning or like natural language processing, which just means understanding language, and giving it the speed and power of a computer.
Why does it work faster than the human brain?
Well, that's a really interesting question. In some ways, it works. You know, of course, you take Google. Google will search virtually the entire contents of the web for the search terms you're looking for. That's because processors and AI working that way in a very narrow application, they're focused on one problem, and they fire at computer speeds, which are thousands of times faster than the simple neuronal firing of our brains. Our brains, however, are doing massive parallel processing in a way that we haven't yet been able to get computers to do. So computers are faster, and they'll continue to get faster. Our brains are firing more, doing more calculations per second in a general sense.
We went from having our little cell phones to our smartphones. What was the major transition there? Because was it the mere fact that a smartphone is really a little computer and the old cell phones weren't?
Yeah, well, the major transition, that's a really good question because, you know, why do we even call them phones anymore? You know, now they're now
exactly.
Yeah. You know, their phones are just, that's just one of the things it does. What that's about is really getting the processor smaller and smaller. Moore's law, which you're probably familiar with, mm-hmm. is a computer term that says, in essence, every year to 18 months, the number of transistors you can put on a computer chip doubles, and the speed cuts in half. So you can put more little electrical switches on that piece of silicon, and they get cheaper every year. So pretty soon, phone developers said, "Well, why are we just doing a phone? Why don't we put a calendar in there? And why don't we put a camera in there? And then why don't we put the kitchen sink in there?"
Yeah.
Now it's a tremendously powerful tool.
Who came up with the idea, James, to send text messages? How did that happen?
That's a good question. I'm not sure of when that happened.
That was dramatic.
Yeah.
That, I think that alone changed the face of smartphones.
Well, that it kind of coincided with, if you remember, the tsunami in Indonesia. That was the kind of the first time when phones were used as kind of reporting tools.
That's right.
Where you could get photographs and text messages all at the same time from different sources who were eyewitness to events. So I think that coincided. That was roughly about the time that texting became this monster. I mean, talk about a way to exchange information quickly.
In your book, Our Final Invention, the subtitle, of course, is Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. So that tells me this isn't all that great.
No, it's not all that great. It's we're entering a very, very volatile and perilous period as computers get smarter and smarter. Computers' intelligence doubles every year. Our intelligence, human intelligence, does not. We'll be eclipsed by machine intelligence. How we manage it is going to determine our future.
I've always wondered if these AIs one day in the future will turn on us.
It's almost that simple. It's not quite. Here's how I anticipate things will go. We create smarter and smarter machines. At some point, the smart machines will be doing the programming. They'll be creating the smart machines. At that point, they'll be able to create smart machines faster than we can, and machines will then set the pace of technological development. In that mix, a couple of things can happen. We can evolve with the machines so that machines are part of us, which is what Ray Kurzweil and a lot of others think will happen, or the machines can simply run out of use for us. We have to think about devices that are thousands of times more intelligent than we are. I know it's kind of a leap.
It's a huge leap, isn't it?
Well, the potential for that to happen is coming up in the next couple of decades.
Yet, isn't it, James, isn't it the human mind that is steering and pushing all this?
It is. But at some point, computers are becoming right now more and more creative. Once there's a milestone that we're going to reach in the 2020s when computers are both self-aware and self-improving. They're aware of their environment and their own coding, their own programs, and they'll be able to program. And then they'll do that. They'll do their own programming and improve their own programming at computer speed, which is faster than we can. At that point, what you were just mentioning, aren't we in charge? Aren't we the ones creating the machines? That is true, and it will be true up to that point. Once we have self-aware, self-improving computers, all bets are off. We can't really anticipate how fast the rate of change will be and whether or not we'll be in control.
I mean, I see one day where a computer, which might be up on a traffic light, sees you go through a red light, and it shoots a beam of lasers at your car and disables it or something until the cops show up.
That's right around the corner. I mean, self-driving cars, there'll be a whole new era of policing. Your car will be, it will have a black box of everything that you've asked it to do. It probably won't be able to break the law. If you rob a bank and try to get away in your self-driving car, I think you'll be out of luck.
True. But are you a drunk driver? If you get in that car, you're inebriated, but you're not driving it.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I think that's one of the real utilities of self-driving cars is, at some point the car will be making all the decisions and you'll just be a passenger.
That's right.
And I think that will be probably, if you went out and you gave everybody a driving test, some people would get A's and some people would get F's and they'd fail. Computers will score, a solid B+ all the time. So you're going to eliminate a lot of traffic accidents.
I saw somebody back in St. Louis. Obviously, she was in a driving school, and, they were on a suburban street trying to parallel park. And the instructor had a couple stanchions as if they were cars, and she had to pull in and park between them. And she tried 20 times, James, 20 times to try to do this. And she can't do it. But they have cars now that do this all by themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're pointing out another very important aspect of computers and processors, and that's their ubiquity. That's that they more and more surround us. In you know, our kitchen now is this beeping thing that reminds us when we leave doors open, when something's been on for too long.
Yeah.
Our kitchen makes more noise than our dog. And it's communicating to us. It's all those devices have little processors and sensors in them. Our cars have in most modern cars now there are 6 or 7 computer processors. In some cars there are hard drives. In the future, you know, cars will be big processing centers as they drive themselves. We carry processors in our pockets. You go into an office and you're surrounded by processors. Anyone's office is going to have, you know, tens or hundreds of processors in an office complex. Another way to look at it, it's like a processor breeding ground. So, our lives are becoming more and more computerized, more and more digitized, mostly to good effect.
Are you excited about the future, even though, you know, you put this question about the end of the human era?
As you can tell, I'm really excited about AI. I really am. I really like AI. But I recognize, as do a lot of AI programmers, and I'm not one. I'm a documentary filmmaker and writer. A lot of AI programmers recognize that artificial intelligence is a dual-use technology, like nuclear fission, like ballistic missiles. Nuclear fission can be used to light up a city or to burn a city.
That's right.
Ballistic missiles can put a nice, useful satellite in space, or they can deliver a warhead. Artificial intelligence, you know, when you think about, you know, if you had to put your finger on what is the most powerful force in the universe that we know of, well, artificial intelligence is the game changer. Intelligence is the game changer. Intelligence is the thing that builds huge buildings, so that creates and destroys environments. When that becomes, when we really put that in the hands of machines, we're going to have to contend with intelligence that isn't like us. It will be like an alien intelligence.
Will AI one day displace workers? It's happened now.
Well, you know what happened to the. You know, what's happening to bank tellers since the ATM was invented, right?
Well, how about the cashiers at stores, that you can sweep through on your own in some places?
Oh, absolutely. The robots that are making cars have replaced, you know, assembly line jobs. We're coming into a real labor crisis because of robotics. And on the one hand, it makes our economy more efficient. On the other hand, it displaces a lot of workers, and it will continue to. That's probably, in the short term, that's the biggest impact we're going to feel from computers. I interviewed, for my book, Our Final Invention, I interviewed a guy who's developed computers and software that can write sports stories.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back. Maybe my Tigers might win the World Series with something like that. You never know. Back with author, researcher, and documentary film producer, Our Final Invention, James Barrett with us. James, you were telling us a story about the person who has software that writes sports stories?
Yes. Let me go back a little bit. You know, we know that computers are starting to replace jobs in bookkeeping, in banking. You know, we talked about the rise of ATMs. They do a lot. Robots do a lot in manufacturing. You know, they put cars together. More and more, they're sneaking into what are more middle-class jobs and not so much clerical or manufacturing. One of them is writing. I interviewed for the book Our Final Invention. I interviewed Robbie Allen of a company in Durham, North Carolina. His trade name is Statsheet. And his programs write 100,000 sports articles a year, and they put them on the web to follow different teams, and they write them almost instantly. All you have to do is feed it the stats, the statistics from the game, and it spits out a story.
As if a great sports writer was writing the thing?
Not a great sports writer, but a pretty good sports writer. I've got, in the book, I've got two sections that are both written, same game, described one by Advanced Analytics, the software that Alan has created, and the other written by a sports writer, and you really can't tell the difference.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And more it's getting into news stories. It'll be creating more and more editorial content.
So here's an example. The Detroit Lions beat the Chicago Bears Sunday. You feed in the stats, right?
Yep.
The runner did 149 yards or something like that. You just throw in all the stats when the scores were done, the quarters, and then the software literally writes a magnificent story about that.
It writes a really good story. And I got the name of the company wrong. It's called Automated Insights out of Durham, North Carolina, and Robbie Allen is the CEO.
That's amazing.
That's exactly what happens, because if you think about it, a sports game is a story with a beginning, middle, and end. It follows a pattern. If you can give that computer some of the jargon, some of the words that sports writers like to use, you know, top of the ninth, beating their way, you know, finding their way back to the top, things like that, then you give it the stats of, you know, how the game developed, how the story developed. It puts out a pretty good article faster than a sports writer could.
And what it wouldn't get, I believe, James, it wouldn't capture the emotion of the event. I mean, would it say, for example, the little boy cried when his favorite player hit a home run?
Maybe it'll say the little computer cried. No, it won't. It's not Red. You know, it's not Red Smith. But that kind of nuance will develop as time goes on. You can, in the book, in Our Final Invention, I've got two columns side by side. They're both about the same event, and I think the computer one is a little bit better, a little bit richer. And the thing is, the reason Alan developed this is because there were a lot of teams that nobody was writing about, but they had a lot of fans.
Mm-hmm.
So his software, it would do this. Check this out. This is really fascinating. It would establish a website for the team, like a high school basketball team. Then it would, whenever it was fed information about a game, it would create a quick sports article about it. And then fans could go to that website and find out about their team. And they couldn't do that before. There was nobody covering the game.
Well, and we know what the internet has done to major newspapers around the country, slowly crushing them. I mean, something like this, you probably could use just an intern feeding the statistics. You wouldn't need that higher paid sports writer.
That's right. You won't. And pretty soon, as I said, you know, it's creeping into writing editorials. It's creeping into writing news. You know, a news story has a beginning, a middle, and end. It's got a formula as well. Obituaries, have a formula.
Yeah.
You plug in the data, and you can get, you know, for computers, language is becoming one of the domains that it's conquering. You know, you talk to your smartphone, that smartphone understands you, which is a gigantic breakthrough in AI. But it's not just writing. You know, more and more, we're going to see computers doing higher level jobs, but more complicated technical jobs. Computers are going to be pharmacists.
They might be talk show hosts one day. Oh boy!
Now I think that's probably a little too skill based right now. It would be we'll have to wait for that one.
But you know what? Down the line, who knows?
Well, you know, Watson, IBM's Watson, really wowed the world when it beat the reigning champions at the game of Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Well, Watson is a Q&A machine, question and answer machine. But it's by far the best in the world. It's the most advanced computer, the most advanced AI really ever created. But what they're doing with Watson now is this: they're training it on medical data, medical case histories. And pretty soon you'll go into a, you'll call your doctor and you'll be quizzed, you know, by a voice. You'll give it, and it will provide a preliminary diagnosis. Then it will pass you on to a real physician, or it'll decide if you'd even need to come in for an appointment. But, you know, as we're saying, computers are replacing increasingly difficult and nuanced jobs, and the medical profession is the next one in its sights.
Now, tell me more about that. I mean, will they replace doctors? I mean, will the computer literally give you your instant analysis of your blood test, for example?
You know, that is well within the possibility right now. But it's gonna take more time. There's gigantic legal issues involved with liability, with getting computers really involved in diagnosing and prescribing medicine. There are legal issues right now they're trying to solve with self-driving cars. Who's liable when two computers mess up and cause a crash? So once those things are settled, yeah, we'll see computers taking nurses' jobs, physicians' assistants' jobs. Certainly the receptionist job is already pretty much gone. And then eventually it'll get to the doctor's job.
Jeez, that's something. I mean, it probably will do the diagnosis. And it might even say, for example, let's say you get your blood test, results go into the computer, and the computer spits out, probably with voice, this is what we need to do. Your type 2 diabetes, your borderline, and you need to do this, this, and this. That's what a doctor does. He gets
the
blood test, and he tells you what he thinks you need to do.
Well, the thing that a doctor is doing, a doctor goes through a long, long internship, long years of training, a long internship. And what he's doing is he's creating a database of cases, of case studies. So once the doctor is mature and well into his career, he recognizes patterns. He recognizes the same symptoms coming up again and again. And that's a very, very valuable skill. Computers
yes.
can do that.
And some good doctors have empathy. I'm not sure a computer would.
I'm pretty sure they won't. that's the $6 million question.
Gosh, of course, you remember, James, when they used to do house calls?
What's that?
Doctors. You don't remember that, do you?
No, I've never seen that happen.
I mean, the doctor who delivered me would literally make house calls to our house. He'd show up whenever mom called him in his little black bag. Of course, we didn't like it when he showed up. But that's what he did. He came to our house and gave us the vaccines, which I'm opposed to. But times have changed.
Well, they sure have. We'll be seeing, you know, the fastest growing segment of where the money is being invested in robotics right now is in elderly care. So you'll have, you know, someday you may be being taken care of by a robot as you get older. In Japan, they're developing, Honda's developed, and a lot of other corporations are developing robots that are intended for elderly care, to do simple things, to get a glass of water, to carry meals, to pick up books, to hand things to an elderly person.
Does AE make robotics, or does robotics make AE? AI.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a good way to think about it is robots are only as smart as the AI inside them. So the AI makes the robot, but some people believe that the only way you can make really good AI is to put it in a body. It's called the embodiment theory of artificial intelligence, because how else is the AI going to learn about the world?
And it needs to move, doesn't it? It needs to feel. It needs to, you know, creep around.
If it's going to do jobs that require those things, if it's going to crank numbers, it doesn't need that. If it's going to figure out mathematical problems, but if it's going to do things in our world, for example, battlefield robots, it needs to be able to get behind the wheel of a car and drive it. It needs to be able to pick up guns that are laying around on the battlefield.
I mean, can you envision a ship with 100,000 robots on it going into battle, and it just, you know, through little PT cruisers, they hit the deck running?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really right around the corner. So that's why, you know, when I talk to people about artificial intelligence, and they say, well, who's developing it? And I say, well, probably the most money being spent on it is being spent by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And what they want to do is create autonomous drones that you feed it a target, it goes out and finds the target and kills it, and autonomous battlefield robots where you field an army of robots. That's not science fiction. Those things are being developed right now.
Do you see RoboCop, for example, patrolling the streets of cities at night, doing whatever it has to do to keep the peace?
I see people becoming very anxious and irate when that happens. But I do see that.
I mean, what happens when it shoots somebody? It kills somebody.
Well, that's a turning point. You know, when we have, you know, when there's, and that's a very, very good question, George. What happens when the first autonomous killer drone takes out a target without a human in the loop, when that first blood is drawn?
By itself.
What happens when that autonomous mall cop shoots a civilian? Those are, you know, the trouble with technological development is that innovation runs way ahead of stewardship. And by that I mean we're excited by the new tools we create. We're thrilled by the new tools. It takes us a while to back up and say, hey, look what we just did. We just mowed over all these people. There was a case where an anti-aircraft robot in South Africa killed 8 people in something like a 12th of a second. And it was a mistake. It fired into the stands during a demonstration.
Jeez.
Yes. And that's, so you get this very, very dire contrast there between a computer's ability, you know, in a 12th of a second versus human ability. So nobody could even react in time. Nobody could even begin to react in time. So we're used to the movies being, you know, feeding us nightmarish robots. Well, we're going to confront them on the battlefield. We're going to confront them in the air.
Well, that's going to happen. There's no doubt about that. And in some cases, it probably already is, isn't it?
Well, you know, we never know what is being developed by DARPA until 10 years after it's created, and then it leaks out, and we finally realize that stealth technology, for example, exists. I have no doubt that right now they're developing autonomous kill drones. I have information that they are. I don't know how successful those drones are. I know that a lot of people are working on autonomous battlefield robots. That's where a lot of money is going. I mean, that's a huge for DARPA. That's a huge goal.
Isaac Asimov, Three Laws of Robotics. Let me read them real fast. A robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given to it by human beings, except where those such orders would conflict with the first law. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Now, when he put this together, was he doing it to be sci-fi, or did he know something?
Asimov was a genius, and those are great laws. He knew a lot about writing stories. He was not trying to create safety rules for the real world. If you read, this comes up again and again when talking about AI and robotics, Asimov's famous three laws. But what he was doing was creating fiction generators. He was creating stories that told about robot problems. If you read his classic collection of stories, I, Robot, every one of them is an example of how unintended consequences come out of those three laws. So in essence, those three laws don't work in the real world. They work at creating dilemmas in stories, but they really won't help us much in the real world. I mean, for one thing, they always conflict. For another, all the terms are pretty nebulous. You know, he talks about injure a human being or through an action letting a human being come to harm. In the future, when robots and humans are, when humans can be enhanced by robotics, then even what we're talking about when we talk about a human is going to change. So there's a bunch of nebulous terms. There's a bunch of unintended consequences that come out of the three laws. So fortunately,
they're bendable,
and there's a great story in there's a great story called Runaround in the collection iRobot, when mining engineers on the surface of Mars ask a robot to retrieve something that's poisonous to the robot, so the robot can't get it because it can't hurt itself, but it can't let the people get it because it can't let them come to any harm. So it walks in circles until the humans rescue it.
I like that. We're going to come back more right here on Coast to Coast AM.